Hi, I'm Jack from Saugerties, and I'm at the radio station with my sister Katie. You're listening to WGXC Aqua. Have a nice day!
Hi, this is Michael Wilde inviting you to Mostly Singles. And if you like what you're hearing, you'll love this show. Rarefied music, premieres, and guests. It's different every time. And a podcast, too. Go to WGXC.org. Mostly Singles, every fourth Tuesday at 8 to 10 p.m. on WGXC 90.7 FM.
Wave Farm programs are made possible in part by the New York State Council on the Arts, with the support of the Office of the Governor and the New York State Legislature, the National Endowment for the Arts, the Greene County Legislature through the Greene County Cultural Fund, the Alexander and Marjorie Hoover Foundation, and hundreds of other generous individual donors, including WGXC monthly supporters, whose generosity and investment keep this unique station viable. You, too, can become a monthly supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate. And establishing a donation at the amount of your choosing. We hope you will do so. Thank you so much for your support.
Wave Farms WGXC is made possible in part by the generous support of Christiana Abel of Housatonic, Massachusetts. WGXC supporters care deeply about creative community radio. Their generosity and investment keep this unique station viable. You, too, can become a monthly supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and establishing a donation at the amount of your choosing. We hope you will do so. Thank you so much for your support.
Take your Wellingtons off, children. And Mammy will tell you a pleasant story.
Good evening, this is Foraging Ahead. I'm Kevin Factor. Tonight on Foraging Ahead, it's spring. Ramps and fiddleheads are up. And to continue my series of taking people who are or should be famous and rich to the point where they shouldn't be spending any time with me at all, I took Amy G. out foraging for ramps in the woods. I'm not going to tell you where it is, because that is not how it goes. Amy G. is a writer, a producer, a director, a comedian, a singer, an actor, a seamstress. I'm sure she's also a juggler. I know she roller skates, and she does gymnastics. She's a remarkable performer. She works in cabarets and theater and television and film and I think on this thing we got called the internet. And now she can say that she is a woods person because I generously introduced her to the world's truly oldest profession, foraging. Amy shares her thoughts on physical comedy and acting and music and the creative process and Facebook and ramps and sort of being Irish, and she gives us a little Irish tune as well that her dad taught her many, many years ago. It was such a pleasure taking her out, and I knew it was going to be great when she shows up in this secret wilderness spot, demurely driving a 2013 Dodge Challenger. It was black with a red racing stripe down the middle, and for a second I thought I was back in Long Island, 1986, but I wasn't. I was in the woods with the incomparable Amy G. It's a beautiful day. I'm with a beautiful human, and we're in a beautiful part of the world, the Hudson Valley, and we're going to go ramp hunting, which is going to be not much different than browsing the aisle of the produce section in a supermarket, right?
Excellent. So, I love your confidence.
No, I see them now.
Oh, good.
So look for the only green things on the ground
over
that you
there?
Can see. Yeah, that those are ramps.
For reals?
Yeah.
Wow, Wow, it is a produce section. Look at this.
Yeah. The world the world is a buffet if you have certain bits of knowledge. So, look at the leaves.
Yeah.
Right?
They're very and just, beautiful now we just, and shiny. Oh, they're so gorgeous.
Pinch like a stalk. And we take one leaf. We used to dig up the bulbs. The bulbs are really good. And take a smell. Have you had these before?
Yeah.
It's sort of garlic and onion. Mm. And, So,
but you don't want to take the bulbs because you want to keep them for next year.
Yeah. Through trial and error, we've learned not to, like, dig them up, even though they're really tasty. But
for sure. You want to be respectful of
absolutely. And a lot of people do this.
Bounty of earth.
Not, you know, now that all you New Yorkers coming up here, you know.
So should I be taking
take one,
the middle one?
Either,
or like
just take one from every, you know, one from a cluster.
Okay. And if there's, it doesn't matter if there's two or three or anything like that.
No, not really. How did you get into whatever it is that you do? It's hard to, you're like Jell-O. You're impossible to nail down. Like,
and I fit into any mold.
And you fit into, even a Camaro.
See? You know, I grew up on the Muppet Show and Carol Burnett.
Yeah.
And I think that kind of explains it.
Yeah, you got definitely a Carol Burnett vibe.
Yeah, and a Muppet vibe. Silly was my way of coping. I was a perfectionist kid that I was super stressed out all the time.
Really?
I had like anxiety headaches when I was 8 years old. Oh. I would hide in the closet and just, I had issues. Mm. And this
so
was not that,
are you telling me you're a comedian with issues?
Yes, exactly. Imagine that. But we didn't have therapy, you know? I just talked to my stuffed animals and made them say silly things. And the silliness set me free. And I feel like that's my job. I am here to help people let the silly set them free.
Hmm.
In whatever way that helps. I mean, I especially laugh at physical comedy.
Hmm.
And that's probably also some Jim Henson and Carol Burnett.
Well, I think
Tim Conway.
I think the great. Yeah, I mean those. I know the Muppet Show and Carol Burnett. I mean that stuff comes from like Yiddish theater and like
classic comedy
classic,
clown duos.
Yeah, like
yeah. Laurel and Hardy,
yeah.
Buster Keaton.
Yeah.
I studied these guys. I studied classic comedy like it was my job. I loved Buster Keaton. I think I had a real crush on him. My grandfather, my father's father, was a vaudevillian.
Okay.
An amateur vaudevillian.
Yeah.
They called him the Little Giant. He was a really short guy, but he was a gymnast and a tap dancer and a ukulele player and a diver and a canoe racer.
Uh-huh.
And just a funny guy that told stories and sang songs, and that's the lineage.
Yeah,
he was raised. He was an orphan that was raised by a guy who, well, he was the captain was his adopted father, but he was much older, and so he had to kind of find a father figure, and they found this father figure in a guy, and I can't believe I'm forgetting his name now, and because I want to say Tommy Tune, but it wasn't Tommy Tune, it was something Tune though. Anyway, this guy taught my grandfather songs and jokes and like gymnastics and stuff like that, and then he was able to raise the captain's kids with all this kind of jovial fun.
Huh.
And was it like in the 20s?
Did you get a chance to meet him?
He lived in Florida, so I didn't get to see him that much. It was kitty corner in the world.
Mm-hmm.
But for sure, he sang us songs and and bounced us around, and got everybody, when I started acting silly and wanting people to watch me act silly, hey everybody, get together, I'm making a show here, I'm gonna be behind the couch, you guys sit here. They were like, yeah, Grandpa Joe.
Yeah. So it wasn't, yeah.
It wasn't too far out. But both my parents are academics and quite, I mean, I wouldn't say my dad was not serious. My mother was pretty serious. She's loosened up a lot over the years. Look at this they came through the leaf.
Mm-hmm.
And the leaf is still attached.
Yeah, no, these are super, super fresh and new.
Yeah.
These are going to be mighty potent.
How many would you put in a recipe? Like, what's the...
There's a couple of ways to work with them. There's several ways. So, you could just throw them into a recipe like you would, like, onion greens, right?
Yeah.
Like, they're amazing with eggs.
Oh, good.
You could brush them lightly with a little olive oil and some sea salt and put them in the toaster oven or the oven.
Yeah.
Just for, at 350.
Yeah.
For about 7 minutes.
Yeah.
Right? To keep an eye on them.
Ooh.
And they'll puff up and turn into the most delicate wafer-like crack, like not even crack, they're just like, and they'll just crumble in your mouth.
You're talking dirty now.
No.
This is exciting to me. Yeah, my dad is the silly side and my mom is the musical side, really.
Oh, okay.
She was the musician.
Did they play when you were growing up and stuff?
Yeah.
And they're still married, or?
He passed away a year ago.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
It's okay. It was his birthday yesterday.
Oh,
Jesus. It's all good. I love that guy. He's still here. He'd love that I was doing this.
What's that?
He'd love that I was out picking, foraging, whatnot. He was an adventurer.
Oh, nice. And he was from New Jersey?
From New Jersey. And
did you hear him?
Neither. It's Irish, of course.
What? Gordon, yeah.
Yeah. It's the Gaelic and the garlic. Yeah, he taught me how to learn. He taught me how to... I was his, like, test subject.
Mm.
He could really...
What would he do that you remember? And you were like, oh, he was running this thing on me.
Like, well, like, when I was very small,
yeah,
he would trot me out at parties and go, Amy, where's your ass? And I'd point to my elbow. Where's your elbow? Just a jokester.
Okay.
You know, doing whatever he could get away with.
Oh, that's okay.
But no, he was such a teacher.
Mm.
You could just ask him about anything, and he'd have a story for it.
Mm. That's the Irish for sure.
Yeah. And New Year's or what do you call it? St. Patrick's Day was a big day around our house. Mm. And you had to perform. My dad, who had been studying Irish songs,
mm,
made sure that my brother and I knew a song in Gaelic.
Oh, wow.
So that we could show up and not embarrass him at a pub.
Oh, wow. Oh, that's amazing. Do you remember it?
Warin ligatunanina me, warin ligatunanina me, warin ligatunanina me, a story known an ailey gay. I can't remember. It's too bad I can't remember the rest. But it's like that. It's nonsense to the ear.
Yeah.
To the English ear.
It's fun.
It's so good.
It's fun to say.
It's very bouncy and fun. Oh, yeah. Yeah. So we learned all those Irish songs, and I have a small cache of Irish songs in my memory that come out. But I was always my father's daughter, and my brother was my mother's son. Like, we were in teams.
You obviously, you must have taken singing lessons.
Yeah.
And gymnastics or something. I mean.
Yeah, I did.
I mean, physical comedy is such a big part of your routine.
Yeah, that's what makes me laugh. That's what
the physical stuff.
The physical stuff. Anything I watch. Like I was watching this. Have you seen The Studio?
No.
It's a new series. It's very funny, but it's because it's slapstick. It's genuine slapstick. They're absolute, and that's when I laugh. I mean, I may chuckle at whatever wordplay. I like wordplay too, but it's the slapstick. It's the stupid pie in the face. Somebody falling on their face. Somebody getting like.
Why? Why do you think that is?
It's just human. It's just human. Just to see an unashamed failure.
Mm.
It feels great. It's a great relief. And that's what laughter is. Laugh is an interrupted sigh, right? Like you're exhaling, but it's interrupted by stress. So that's the pattern that you're trying to elicit, the breathing pattern that you're trying to elicit.
Mm.
So you're trying to give a sense of relief while there's still tension.
Mm.
So watching somebody fall it's funny because it's not supposed to be funny. So there's tension in like, oh no, that shouldn't be happening, but because it is, because that's our major fear, and there it is happening, so there's a relief in that.
So experiencing our fears.
Yeah.
Which is
fear and failure.
Fear and failure.
Just confronted without shame.
Mm.
So that is what drove me into clown, and that is what clown is, and that like from my studying all the classic comedy folks, I started studying clown. I found a clown teacher who I could trade babysitting. I babysat his kid, and then I like worked with him in the studio, and I.
What is some clown 101? Like I don't. Because it's hard. I know in France there's like a clown school.
Lecoq, yeah.
Yeah, and
I worked with that guy.
It's kind of foreign.
It
comes up to the American sensibility.
We
tend to think things. Someone's either just funny or not funny. Right?
Yeah.
And that's not necessarily something that you can study and learn and develop.
Yeah.
Even though every comedian or every writer or whatever is like starts with something but then goes through years of development.
Of course.
But
you'll only develop what you're interested in. And things came pretty easy to me. I was a smart kid. I liked learning. I had that father just taught me all the tricks to learning. So school was a breeze. I, you know, did all. I had traveled the world. I had picked up languages. It was all seeming pretty easy. And I remember at one point in college, I was taking acting courses and stuff like that, and that was good and fun and presented a certain challenge. But. I was like, what's the hardest thing I could do? What's the thing that would be actually will provide the most challenge for the rest of my life? And I thought, that's comedy.
Really?
I was so serious.
Mm. So you went into comedy because you felt like it was the opposite of who you were naturally?
Yeah. Yeah, it was a challenge.
Hmm.
It was like, you're a scaredy cat and you're bitterly ashamed of everything that you do and say. So
I find that so hard to believe.
Right? Because there has been a transformation. Mm. But it has been hard won.
Mm.
I have worked on that. And I have to continue to work on that.
Mm.
Because it's a lifetime thing. I actually picked pretty well if I wanted a lifetime of difficulty.
Mm. Well, at least you never bored.
Exactly. And that was a big fear.
Boredom.
Yeah. Really? I mean, not that I got bored easily, but I did feel like most things were pretty easy.
Yeah. Yeah.
As far as, like, I don't know. I wasn't pre-med or anything. I was in a state school taking acting classes. So It's still hard. All of it.
What, the comedy? The
comedy's hard. Writing's hard.
Writing is hard.
The nature of the beast where I have to do everything. I have to market. I have to direct. I have to make the costumes. I have to get the people in the audience. I have to design the lights. I have to set price points. I have to design a tour. I have to plan the tour. I have to book the tour. All that, and I've done that in different ways. Like, I've been a part of theater companies that where I'm doing it for a larger group, or I've been a part of theater companies where I'm a cog in the wheel, and I just get to show up, and that's fun too. But you don't get paid as much, and you know, there's a whole thing, or just being an actor in a TV show, mm-hmm. which is a whole other ball of wax, and certainly a ball of wax I'd like to be rolling around more, because that is much easier.
And probably more lucrative.
So much more lucrative. It's so much fun. And there's a lot, big group of people that you're... I love ensemble stuff. And I've ended up being a solo performer, much to my everlasting chagrin. Mm. Just because that's what you have to do to survive.
And how long have you been, like, making a living at this? I mean, it's kind of... Honestly, it's kind of remarkable. Like... The amount of talented, brilliant people who live around here,
yeah.
you know?
Yeah, it's uncanny.
And I go, it's just the same to you. It's just like, why are you talking to me?
Because you're another talented, brilliant person.
No.
With so much to share.
No, but I mean, you should
Plus,
be...
Plus, you're listening. You're watching me do things.
I'm watching you doing what I showed you how to do.
I'll do anything if somebody's watching.
I'm glad this is radio.
Me too.
How come you're not filthy rich and living, you know?
It's so hard. Do you have any idea?
No, I do.
It's so hard. I mean, I believe in my talents. I know how much I bring to any production. Mm-hmm. I really do. Mm. Because I've done my own productions. I've been a part of massive productions. I've been a part of tiny productions. I've won Olivier Awards in the London's West End. Like, I've been a part of big things, and I've made good things all by myself. So I get my value.
Yeah, yeah.
But the world doesn't. Not that anybody that sees me does, but it's really hard to not be a corporate entity.
Yeah.
It's really hard to not, and I think that's the case for anybody that's trying to do anything independently mm-hmm. nowadays, because mm-hmm. it's corporate money that's selling to everybody else. Mm. So if I don't have a corporation behind me that's marketing my stuff, mm-hmm. then it doesn't get to the same audience. I was making stuff for Facebook a year ago. I just got the wild hair up my butt to start, like, monetizing Facebook and make comedy videos and do the thing, and I did it, and I figured it out, and I was really nutting in on how it all works.
Mm-hmm.
And I amassed a following of something like 20,000 followers, and I had millions of views on some of my videos, and I was getting it. And then I just got kicked off Facebook for no reason. Mm. Just said your account has been disabled, and I haven't been able to get on since.
Oh no.
I was not paid for the millions of views, even though I was monetized. You know, like, there's a corporate entity that is in charge of what we actually see for the most part,
mm-hmm.
unless we're out here foraging for ramps in the woods.
Yeah.
Because this is, that's why this is so pleasant.
Yeah, and it's also quasi-illegal.
Oh, good. That makes it even better.
I know, that's why I said sensible bag. And actually, I threw like a protein bar in my bag in case we got pulled over and I could say,
we're
just having a picnic. As soon as you introduce market forces into
this, something like this,
yeah,
you completely change the dynamic. You completely change, because we're going to get enough for a nice, for a meal, you know, you can make a little pesto, you can do a little sort of like ramp wafers or something, or ramp and eggs, on, you know. And then, like, later, maybe you come back in a week or whatever and get some more. Even if you get a bunch for pickling, and you're going to lose some. But, because you don't, there's only so much you want to eat. Because, frankly, if you eat ramps more than a couple of days in a row, you're really going to... Well, not you might not be, but other people around you.
Certainly.
like...
Okay, enough with the ramps already.
Yeah, you... But if you're just going to sell them, you have a completely different incentive, right? You're going to just take everything you possibly can.
Yeah.
And so if
and this is how I feel about Facebook. I feel like they are treating our attention in the same way that those
100%
people are treating the ramps.
There's a little munchkin. Yeah.
Because they're not actually trying to give you nourishing, delicious, hilarious content. And I hate the word content. It's just the opposite of
when
what I want to be creating.
When did that become... Yeah.
Once they started trying to fill your attention, like they fill walls, right? That's content.
Yeah.
Is the nasty insulation that you put between your walls. Anyway, I feel like the monetized Facebook accounts that are out there and making serious bank are following formats that are treating people's attention like this, like just grab and sell. Create a thing that takes people's attention from them without giving them anything real in return, and try to get the most people's attention for the most time without actual nourishment, with zero laughs, zero like meaning. Just watch this person do something for long enough that there can be 7 ads in it. So I stopped. I had to really like come to Jesus this year, just a month ago or so, because they were going to recycle my page since it had been disabled for so long.
What do you mean recycle it?
Well, give it to somebody else, do something else with it, so that I would have nothing to do with it anymore. Or I could start again and try to continue and start from scratch with a whole nother trying to build up and blah, 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 blah.
Did they ever give you an explanation why they suspended
you? No explanation. Nothing.
And there's no court of appeals or anything?
Nothing I can
do. That's what's so terrifying.
Yeah.
It really is, because they could just turn the switch. You have no idea why. Yeah. This is like it's like an authoritarian or totalitarian state.
It is.
You know,
you get to thinking, oh, these are my fans. But they're not your fans. They're Facebook's fans, because Facebook can give them to you or take them away. So they may like you and have signed up to hear more from you, but it's Facebook has the mailing list. Facebook is the one that has the way to them. So I wish I could reach a wider audience. I wish I could be a celebrity, because that would give me access to people that I want to work with. You know, I want to play with the big kids. You know?
I
would do well in those waters, but I play small rooms, because that's my mailing list.
But you still manage to make a living.
I do, and I've made a living since January 1st, 2000.
Chutzpah. I mean,
I have to go far and wide for it.
We're actually going to think about charging that. So if somebody's interested in finding out more about Amy G, where might they go?
Well, I have a website, amy-g.com. I have a YouTube channel. which I think is Amy G. Entertainment. Entertainment was the name of my show that I did for a long time. And I have all sorts of social media accounts that will drive you through the whole Amy G. Adventure land. Yeah, there's hundreds of videos on spread around those various places, short and long, of all the various kinds of shows that I've done. Most of my acts, I'm singing these days.
Yeah.
And I, when I was first learning clown, I had a teacher that said, you just need a reason to be on stage. And then the rest is what, and the rest is the important part. You know, like what you do with them once you have them, or what you do with your time and space on stage is yours, but you have to have a reason to be there.
Mm.
So singing lately has been my reason to be there.
Mm.
Because
it's a great reason, by the way.
I'm still a chicken to just call myself a comedian and just go up and just be a comedian.
Mm.
I feel, while some, I've done full shows where I only sang three songs in an hour, but it's still a bit of a crutch for me.
Hmm.
And I think, you know, any comedian that you talk to that's like, oh, you're a singer, and this, suddenly you go down in their estimation.
Oh.
Because you have that crutch. Like, comedy magician, or comedy juggler, or comedy, you know, like, these are lesser citizens in the comedy world. We are lesser
that's
citizens.
Funny. That's funny. I mean, think of all the fantastic, like, comedians who exclusively, work through song.
Yeah, and people like Zach Galifianakis. When I did Just for Laughs, the gala, I was on a bill with Zach Galifianakis when he was still at the piano.
Oh, yeah.
Have you ever seen those?
Yeah.
Sets? Brilliant.
Yeah, yeah.
So good. Because music gives you timing immediately.
Mm.
And I think that, for me, I love singing, and I work so much in cabaret and circuses that you have to have an act. You know, I can't just walk out on stage as a comedian. So singing is my act. And then I get to use that for comedy's purposes. So I think it's also really useful in setting up character, because everybody understands who that diva is singing that song. Whatever that song is, I go for the big, high drama, big diva songs, because one, they're super fun to sing and really challenging. I like that challenge. But it also is such a high pedestal to fall from, because that's comedy. Like, if they, and people have such a, at least in the beginning of my career, I had a really hard time trying to figure out how to help people laugh at me, because they took me so seriously as a, like, tall, symmetrical, you know, dramatic looking woman.
Mm.
They think of me as a serious, they get serious when they see me, like, oh, this is
no, you don't have the classic sort of comedian, like,
I'm not that round best friend. I don't have that look where I played second fiddle. I played the young. I was ingenue for long enough, where I could learn to fall and learn to I did a lot of pratfalls. I did so many pratfalls. I was so bruised all the time.
Oh really?
Yes.
You just get bruised doing that?
Yes.
There's no getting around it?
No. I mean, it depends on what you're falling on, but most of these stages are hard.
Yeah.
They're hard, hard stages. Yeah. I'd rather a hard stage, because then I was also roller skating. That was another, just reason to be on stage, or a way to be clumsy and have people believe you.
Mm.
So I was looking for ways to take myself down a notch, just physically. And first, singing did that, because I wasn't a good singer. So trying,
really?
Yeah, I mean, whatever, I could sing. I always sang, but I was not as a, like, I didn't have...
You didn't have the...
I didn't have
the,
what I have now.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you got it now.
I got it now. I've worked real hard at it.
Oh.
But having a, like, roller skating, I was a terrible roller skater. And I was roller skating on stage for years before I got a coach and learned how to roller skate because it was... It was funny. This most important thing is to be bad.
Yeah.
To be believably bad and unashamed. Mm. To be a living, unapologetic failure that keeps trying. Mm. That's Clown 101. So I just gave myself a precarious position. And when I work with people today, like I'm starting to direct a clown in the city this next week, and she's a tap dancer. And she sent me a video, and I'm like, you know what? You're such a fantastic dancer. And we need to find a way to get you more precarious. We need big problems to be able to add to the mix. We need this floor to be slippery. We need you to lose a shoe. We need you to start losing your clothing. We need to, you know, whatever it is that's going to make life really hard for you and be repeatable. That's the trick. Mm. Like, let's find the accidents that can happen naturally and then have you deal with that. That's my clown 101. But you have to be in that class for a long time.
Yeah, yeah. Similarities and differences between inhabiting a song or inhabiting a comedic set piece.
I have to learn the song first and be super facile and comfortable with the song. Mm. And, you know, sometimes I'm just paid to sing. And then I'm just doing that. And then sometimes I'll find how to make it funny. Mm. But it's not yet a set piece until I figure out who it is. What's the character? Who is the character that makes this song funny? Mm. So, like, I Who Have Nothing, the big Shirley Bassey number. Mm-hmm. I've done it in a couple of different ways that both work. One, as a woman that obviously has everything, fur coat, jewels, and a trophy with a big crown. You know, like, somebody that obviously has everything, but she's still unsatisfied. Mm-hmm. So that's a tension there. So people understand the character. They hear the song, and now there's a joke, because there's tension between there. And then you got to find ways to show her desperation in that situation. Mm-hmm. And I like to talk through song. I like to add my just add comedy, actual, you know, saying things or things that happen. So if I can press my nose up against an actual window pane, singing that lyric, it's especially if it's a big diva that's like you wouldn't expect to be so silly. Mm-hmm. Then that's also that works. I've also done that act after I've completely stripped down because I've gotten my clothes were all wet and I have to get out of them, and so now I'm just in a terrible leotard. Mm. And a bra on my head, like I've got nothing. I actually have nothing. So, picking the song and then finding out who it is and then figuring out the gags. Mm. And any one of those, like, sometimes the gags make the song hard. Sometimes the character makes the gags weird because you have to make it believable that those gags would be coming from that character. Like each of those layers, and then there's a costume. Mm-hmm. And the costume should complicate it, should make it more dynamic. Mm-hmm. Should have other moving parts that are happening and be another visual layer. Mm-hmm. So eventually it adds up, but the song has to come first because that's where it starts. Mm-hmm. And that kind of thing.
What were you doing in Florida?
In Florida, I was doing Mr. Swindle's Traveling Peculiarium, which is a a traveling show. It happens in a tent. And they're world-class variety artists. And kind of an adult aesthetic that's got this sort of 18th century character, Dr. Elixir, who's a kind of a medicine show. He's selling elixirs, mm-hmm. and they have a drinkery garden out front. And so it's for adults. They don't use the word circus because they're from circus, and they have big feelings about this is not a circus because it's not the kind of circus that they grew up in. Because they grew up as a part of, you know, Ringling Brothers, oh. as the flying trapeze mm-hmm. family, mm-hmm. and seven generations mm-hmm. of flying trapeze artists. So it's not that. It's adult, and it's sexy, and it's silly, and it's got a light narrative. But it does have world-class circus acts. Hmm. And I'm the comedian in that structure. Oh. So I get to work with them to develop a through line so that the audience has somebody to relate to.
Mm-hmm.
That's not a creepy medicine show guy and or a fully unbelievable contortionist that's hanging by her hair. And, you know, that's not to be related to. It's just to put you in a state of awe.
Hmm. And you were in the same locale for the whole time?
No,
or
we traveled.
Travel
we did like
all around
seven
Florida,
cities.
Seven different cities in Florida.
Yeah, like staying anywhere 2 weeks to one week to a month,
mm-hmm.
in each town, and then moving on.
Mm. And what were the audiences like?
Old and white and Republican.
Is that right?
Yeah, it's pretty diverse. Oh. They have every kind of Republican.
Every kind of old white Republican.
Yeah.
Really.
But with that. They were amazing. They're an incredible crowd.
Mm.
They're willing to laugh at themselves.
Mm-hmm.
They're there for a good time.
Mm-hmm.
They're totally shameless. They got no problems about laughing at themselves or laughing at me or laughing at the world or laughing at America. I mean, they really did. They surprised me and delight me in a way that I never could have imagined.
Mm.
And right before that, I did 2 months in Switzerland,
mm-hmm.
which was completely the opposite. So when I arrived in Florida, it was just a balm in Gilead. You know, my whole system just relaxed, and I was able to just have so much fun. I killed every night. It was so simple. They just enjoy it, and they are vocal about it. Americans are amazing. In general, Americans are a great crowd. But old people are the best.
Old Americans. Yeah.
And not all old people, I guess. Old Americans, oh, they're wonderful. I love the elders. They are just, they don't have as many to give. They're really, they're a joy.
Yeah.
They're happy to be entertained, and they're Florida, they're day drinking.
Not all of these are ramps.
Right.
You can tell the difference.
Yeah, some of them are like irises.
Yeah. Boom.
This just noticing things.
Yeah.
Being a totally different interaction with the world than being sold. Which is basically how they are interacted with by everybody but their parents.
Yeah. This is, yeah. Or...
And who knows, maybe even their parents are trying to sell them on ideas as far as like, hey, don't you want to go to bed
or that they
go
live
to college?
In a, yeah. Oh, no, it's just, everything's a sales job. Which,
yeah.
And it's just depressing. You know,
It's not the human experience, but it's not the
totality. Exactly.
Of the human experience.
And it's such a richer one when you can be attuned to that which is subtle, those subtle energetic layers, mm-hmm. and coming off of the ground and the water mm-hmm. and yourself mm-hmm. and your feet or your ears or your mouth or whatever, however you're taking in the world,
mm-hmm.
anything, even just in how you hear words, when you can hear the subtleties of communication, you're hearing a whole nother layer of person-to-person, like, information.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, I think we're losing that, because I think, like, reading gives you that more than anything. Unless you're going to be surrounded by, you know, in a rich language environment, right?
Yeah.
Which, I mean, the Irish, that's just natural, right? But that comes from, like, generations and generations of and practicing and talking as entertainment and conversation as an activity, right? And you don't get that in a lot of different countries. You don't get that in...
Certainly don't.
So...
Although the French love to hear themselves speak. I like to hear myself speak French,
yeah,
too.
Yeah.
It's very sexy.
But, yeah, no, like subtlety doesn't sell.
No.
Subtlety doesn't sell.
Although it is where life is. Like, that's where you get the real goods as far as knowing, like, your own intuition
mm-hmm.
or knowing what you like.
Mm-hmm.
Knowing, being able to follow a thing that interests you. You would not get from being sold that line.
Mm-hmm.
You would get that from going, I have this sort of, like, tickle in my belly right now that's also kind of makes my knees a little bit wobbly, and I feel a little lightheaded, and I think I like this feeling, and it's that this song is playing, and there's this breeze happening, and all of this adds up to, I like this, so let me listen to this song at a later moment, or let me open the window at a moment when I'm not feeling so hot, and see which one of those elements is the thing that makes my life better. And being able to actually be attuned to your own experience, to be able to make it how you want it, instead of being a consumer of whatever you can afford, and then always feeling behind the eight ball that you can't afford the thing that you want. I think that's a shift in understanding that is, I don't know if everybody's losing it, but I know I feel better when I can take some time to try and get subtle, try to listen subtly, try to feel subtly, try to understand more subtly what people are trying to communicate to me, or what the earth is trying to give me, or what a line in a book is trying to give me, or whatever. It just takes a little bit more attention.
One of my favorite things is not understanding something, which happens a lot, but like this is really interesting. I don't think I totally understand it. I'm gonna put it in here, and just, like, wait on it.
Yeah.
And then every now and then, you'll go, oh,
I get it.
Like, something will happen.
Yeah.
Like, and then,
that's how the mind works. I mean, my father would have explained this much more eloquently than I can.
But, like, a poem will come up. Like, I haven't. It's like, you know, kids go, oh, when am I ever going to use this? You know, I heard this poetry. I'm like, you know what? Just read this poem, you know, and just we'll just say it out loud a couple of times. It's not going to hurt you, you know? And then maybe in 20 years, something will happen. You go, oh. And that line will come up,
or that image will come
and
up.
And you will get the
and
girl.
And you're going to connect.
You're going to impress that person in that job interview.
No, poetry.
Poetry gets the girl.
It totally does. There was this woman I was working with in California, and she was absolutely beautiful, but she had this like birthmark, right? You know, on mm-hmm. her thing. She was really self-conscious about it. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I love that. I said, that's my favorite thing about you, because
that she felt so bad about it.
No, the fact of it. Yeah. And then I told her the story. I think it was a Nathaniel Hawthorne story called "The Birthmark,"
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Oh no, "The Alchemist." He was the alchemist.
Oh,
you know
yeah,
that one?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And he married this beautiful woman, and she had this birthmark, and he became obsessed with. She was perfect in every way, you know, except for this one flaw, and he wanted to fix that flaw. And as soon as he fixed the flaw, she just existed for a moment in total perfection, and then disappeared. Right?
Yeah.
Because this world is not for the perfect or perfection, you know. So I told her that, you know, until she learned more about me, we were good for a couple of weeks.
Bought you some time.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
No, absolutely. And the way that lines like that can come. Can surface,
or just, yeah,
or connections mm-hmm. can be made in the back of your head.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't happen if you're doing something.
If you
constantly... got to be doing like a little bit of nothing.
Oh, or a lot of bit of nothing.
Or yeah, a lot yeah, of bit yeah, of nothing yeah. in order for those connections to resurface.
Mm-hmm. But then we go back to the sort of Protestant Catholic dynamic,
yeah.
which is. They say that Protestants play to work,
mm-hmm.
and Catholics work to play. Yeah.
I wonder where the Baptists come in all that.
Oh, good. All right. I don't know.
You know, I'm on day 5 of learning the piano.
Really?
Yeah.
You're learning the piano.
I'm learning the piano.
Yeah.
Keys, anyway.
Well, they say you know, learn it young, so.
Yeah, so 50's
good
pretty
for
good.
You. Yeah.
Still have plenty of life left.
Oh, my God.
So I've started learning, and I have this a totally different relationship to practice now than I was when, the last time I played piano, which was, I don't know, I was 9.
Yeah.
I had a terrible teacher. I hated her.
Yeah.
And my mother also played piano, and that was also bad.
It was a burden. So, yeah, no, I get it.
So, but now I love practice.
Really?
I love it. Of course, I've spent my whole life practicing. I live in circuses, you know, like, I love practice. It's so zen. It's such mm-hmm. a wonderful thing to just climb up that learning curve.
Mm.
So much fun. And that thing of not being able to put the fingers in the thing together in the rhythm and try to have them move independently and all of that. And then
you can just
my
feel
father,
the brain.
I can feel my father saying, take a break, walk away.
Mm-hmm.
You make connections that you would never make when you're not practicing.
Yeah.
So you rest, come back, even just 10 minutes later. And
trust
I'm like,
your brain.
Oh.
Yeah, yeah.
And then there's a flow there.
Yeah. Do you feel like, do you know when you've done your scene in TV or film or whatever, that when you've nailed it, or I mean, are you just like, ah, that was it? Or,
I can have a sense. I can have,
a sense
of
it,
but I don't. I haven't seen the rest of it because ultimately it's about how it goes into the whole, and that is, you know, the director and the editor will know which one goes best into the whole, and. I have not played that many lead characters. I mean, in smaller things, I played a lot of leads, but in big things, I am playing tertiary characters.
Mm-hmm.
So my job is a supporting piece.
Mm-hmm.
So I just have to do the thing that does right by the
mm-hmm.
the whole show.
Mm-hmm.
But for something like a scene where Like, I did a pilot, a comedy pilot, where I wrote it and I produced it and I was the lead character.
Big time.
So that was, I knew, and it was up to me, and I was going to be editing it. Mm. And so I should have directed it. I didn't. That was a mistake. But I did know in those cases, I felt like I knew when I'd nailed it. Because I knew what I was going for. And yeah, when you disappear, it's best. Like when there is no technique bubbling to the surface, when you are, for instance, I do an act on where I'm tap dancing on roller skates while playing a ragtime ukulele, right, and telling jokes and
as one does,
like as you know, that's yes, exactly, that's as this one does. So many layers, like the simultaneity. You can't be thinking about any one of them, because the only thing that's important is your connection to the crowd. And same thing for a storytelling moment. You may have a bunch of, you've got to, you know, remember all the pieces to the story and all that, but that is not what is going to make the thing good. What is going to make the thing good is your communicating the feeling of that moment to the crowd.
Yeah.
And but, living in that feeling and delivering that as a clear channel, that's what's going to make that story ring in their hearts.
Mm-hmm.
Not the words that you said the one time that you thought you said it real well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So trying to keep the at bay all of your ideas of perfection from the last time you did it up to your own standards, all that has to be excused. And whenever I would go on stage with that slapstick roller skating act, I would have to excuse the night before and say, thank you so much. I learned so much from you. Tonight is new. And go out and do a completely other thing, because it was not choreographed in as much as I knew there were gags and tricks that I would get to, but it doesn't make sense on a 6-foot round stage when you're surrounded by an audience to try and manufacture a thing that happened last night.
Mm.
Suddenly you're a hack.
Mm.
You can only use what's actually happening.
Mm-hmm.
And if there's a feeling in you that's happening, and again back to that subtle recognition, like being able to be aware of the subtle thing that's happening, like if you feel fear in your belly, being able to communicate that and let it out, to confess it, to relieve it and give it as a gift so they don't have to feel it or they get to feel yours.
Mm.
That's the gift in whatever medium, if that's music or theater or comedy or film or whatever, being able to be actually aware of what's happening in your own being and being able to communicate it, because that's the thing that's happening there is a thing that guaranteed has happened to everybody in the audience, is a feeling. Because we share feelings.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of all we share.
Mm.
Thoughts are whatever, but feelings, everybody's got.
I'm so glad we had this time together, just to have a laugh or sing a song. Just get started, and before you know it,